Thank you very much for that introduction and for having me. Fantastic. So I'm going to be speaking to you today about real-life social networks, not just the online variety, a kind of recent development in our evolutionary history, which is nevertheless grafted onto a very ancient past. So we humans have been making social networks for tens of thousands of years, ever since we emerged onto the African savanna. But these networks that we make are grounded and bounded by certain fundamental biological and sociological principles. And I want to emphasize that I'm not a genetic determinist, nor overly positivistic. I think that there are numerous explanations for social phenomena that are not mutually exclusive. Still, social networks are a kind of biosocial phenomenon. They have biological predicates, and they have biological consequences. And the structure and function of human social networks are, we think, deeply rooted in our evolutionary past. And this past affects us even in the networks we make nowadays using online and telephonic media as if they were grafted onto an ancient set of tendencies. Now, like other species, human beings can be seen as evolving under the pressure of the environment that they face. And this environment can be seen as composed of three different types. There's, of course, the physical environment, the sunlight, the temperature, the water supply that we face, the biological environment, the predators, the prey, or the pathogens, and interestingly, the social environment, who or what surrounds us. And this social environment is typically neglected as an evolutionary force. Yet social factors are crucial. They may, for example, have led us to being intelligent. And in fact, the social brain hypothesis posits that one of the reasons we human beings are intelligent at all is the necessity not to make tools, but rather to make friends. Our assembly into groups may have accelerated, if not have created, the tendency to think. And this theory stresses the special challenges posed by living in close proximity with others of one's own species and confronting the demands of a complex social environment involving constant cooperation or competition. And what is interesting, at least to me, about the social environment is that more so than the physical and biological environment, at least until recently, we humans, both individually and collectively, create this environment. So unlike the physical and the biological environments, which are sort of exogenous to us, we create the social environment. We therefore create a kind of selection pressure which can feed back upon us and modify our evolution. Plus, as a further side matter, we create the social environment over, or can do so, over relatively short time intervals, unlike the physical or biological environment. So here's a picture of a natural social network, a kind of environment we create and live out our lives within. Each of us, so every dot is a person, every line between the two people represents a relationship between people, and each of us chooses our friends and our colleagues and our spouses, and we inherit our relatives, and so do all the others, and as a result, we make these ornate, beautiful structures, and then we proceed to live out our life embedded in the structure. You know, you are here, or you are here, or you are here, and this is the kind of social environment that you come to occupy. And this image, taken from one of our first studies, helped us to understand the role of obesity or the role of social networks in obesity. It had become trendy to speak about the obesity epidemic. And it's clear that obesity in the United States and in the UK is epidemic in one meaning of the word, which is that there's more of it than there used to be before. But we wondered whether we could understand obesity as epidemic in another meaning of the word, as if something were literally spreading from person to person. Could we discern evidence for a kind of social contagion, a kind of spreading process in the network, whereby as I gained weight, my friends gained weight, and then my friends' friends gained weight, and there was a kind of spread of weight gain within the social system? And this is one of the pictures that we generated in order to begin to study that process. Every dot's a person. Bigger dots are bigger people. And we also color the dots yellow if people are properly obese. And so the non-obese individuals are red, the obese individuals are yellow. And if you look at this image, you might be able to discern that there are clusters or seemingly perhaps outbreaks of obesity within the social fabric. Nevertheless, the complexity is still very high, visually speaking. And several questions are raised by this clustering. For example, first of all, how much clustering is there? Is there more clustering than simply due to chance? And how big are the clusters? What's the radius of the clusters? And finally, and most interestingly, what might be the cause of the clusters? So we borrowed some ideas from statistical physics, and we did a kind of so-called topological permutation test. And basically, the results of that analysis suggest the following. On the y-axis is the increase in the probability that a person is obese given that a social contact is obese, and on the x-axis is the degrees of separation dividing the two people. And what this slide says is that if your friends are obese, you've got a 45% higher likelihood of being obese yourself. And if your friend's friends in red are obese, you've got a 25% higher likelihood. And if your friend's friend's friends are obese, you've got a 10% higher likelihood. So it's only when I get to your friend's 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 friends at 4 degrees of separation that there's no longer an association between that person's body size and your body size. So if I knew nothing else about you, then the body size of this person who's almost certainly a stranger to you, your friend's friend's friends, or your friend's friends, for example, I would be better than chance able to predict your body size. If obesity were randomly and uniformly distributed through this sociotopological surface, this fabric of humanity, these social networks, these lines would have been 0% across the board. So this analysis tells us two things. First of all, there's more clustering than due to chance. And second, the radius of these clusters is to 3 degrees of separation. But it doesn't tell us what might be causing the clusters. And there are at least three possibilities. One idea is a kind of social domino effect or induction. So here I gain weight and it makes Jennifer gain weight, and Jennifer gains weight and it makes her students gain weight, and there's a kind of spreading process through the network. A second possibility is homophily, or love of like, or birds of a feather flock together. Here the idea is that it, not that my weight gain causes Jennifer's weight gain, but rather that Jennifer and I form a relationship in the first place because we share a similar body size or similar interest in things that might cause our body sizes to co-vary, or homophily. And the last possibility is confounding. Here the idea is not that my body size causes Jennifer's body size, nor that Jennifer and I form a relationship because we have a similar body size to begin with, but rather that we share an exposure to something like a gym that makes us both lose weight, or a fast food joint that makes us both gain weight at the same time. Typically, all three of these things are present in any social process. You know, are your children and their roommates or their friends both good students because one of their studiousness causes the other studiousness because they were both studious to begin with and they form a connection? Or they have inspirational teachers that cause them both to become studious? Or same thing goes with drug abuse. Are your students and their peers using drugs at the same time because one is causing the other, they're forming a relationship, or there's a local pusher that's making them both adopt drug use behavior? So you can use a variety of statistical and econometric techniques to disarticulate the existence of these three phenomena. And we've done so when we found evidence using both observational and experimental methods for the existence of all three of these things within social systems. But eventually, a variety of mechanisms might underlie the spreading processes within networks. But eventually, we moved on to study other phenomena. For example, when human beings have emotions, we show them. Why do we show our emotions? It's not hard to construct arguments from evolutionary biology as to why we would have emotions, why it would increase our fitness to feel anger or happiness or fear or disgust. But not only do we have those as internal states, but we show them. And not only do I show them, but you can read it. And not only do you read it, but you copy it. It would seem that emotional contagion is a very deep and fundamental aspect of human emotional experience. And this function of emotions suggests that whatever other advantages they offer, they're also a primitive form of communication. Now, we're accustomed to thinking about emotional contagion as fleeting and involving just a pair of people. And I gave a talk about some of this work a few years ago in New York City. And I said, you know, when you're in the subway and you look across the car in the subway and the person smiles at you and you just instinctively smile back? And they said, we don't do that in New York City. And I said, well, everywhere else in the world, that's normal human behavior. And so we're accustomed to thinking about emotional contagion in that fashion. And we also can think or are accustomed to thinking about emotional contagion in broader spreading processes. For example, in the form of riots, the spread of anger in the form of riots. But we wondered whether emotions might spread beyond pairs of people, and might they do so in a more sustained way than riots? Could there be a kind of a quiet riot? Could there be a kind of below-the-surface emotional stampede rippling below the social fabric that we assemble ourselves into? Maybe emotions spread beyond across network ties, well beyond pairs, and in a more sustained fashion all the time. In fact, maybe emotions have a collective existence, not just an individual existence. So we did, and we published what I think was the first network map of human emotions. Every dot is a person. Every line represents a relationship, spousal or friendship or coworker or other relationships. Here we color the dots according to whether they are happy or sad. The yellow dots are happy people. The blue dots are sad people. And if you look at this image, you can see clusters of unhappy and happy people within the network. And these clusters also spread to 3 degrees of separation. And you might even have the intuition in looking at this image that the unhappy people are more likely to be located on the periphery, structurally, the periphery of the network, and the happy people are more likely mathematically, confirmed with mathematical analyses, more likely to occupy central locations. Well, to get around some of the problems with drawing conclusions from observational data, and to dig deeper into the evolutionary significance of networks, we've also begun to do some experiments, creating artificial networks to study. These are a paper we just published in PNAS a couple of years ago now. Here what we did is we took advantage of data that involved college students who were strangers to each other that were brought into the laboratory. And they were brought into the lab and they were randomly assigned to interact in groups of four. And they played a so-called public goods game, a kind of economic game that Jennifer just alluded to. Each individual was given a small sum of money. They could pay a price and sacrifice their own benefit and give the money to the collectivity. If they did that, the researcher would multiply the money, everyone would benefit, but the individual would pay a price. So it's a classic trade-off between individual good and collective good. So the best behavior of any given individual is to free ride, to defect, to hope that everyone else contributes and to do nothing themselves. But if everyone does that, the group suffers. Conversely, at the other extreme, if everyone is generous and kind, then everyone benefits much better than any given individual would otherwise have done. So what happened in this experiment is the individuals were brought together, they were strangers, they were randomly assigned to interact with each other, then a bell would ring and they would interact with new individuals, then a bell would ring and they would interact with new individuals across time. And you could take these data and reconstruct an artificial network. And you could ask the following question, not if I am kind to David, does he reciprocate the kindness and is kind to me, which is direct reciprocity, which is very interesting, but not so hard to understand in some ways. I mean, a lot of important research has been done on this topic. But rather, if I am kind to David, does he then go on to be kind to Olivia, and then Olivia goes on to be kind to Larry? Is there a kind of spreading process within the network? Could we actually find evidence for a kind of pay-it-forward process within the system? And in fact, that's exactly what we found. What we found in this network, and confounding and homophily cannot be explanations here because this is under experimental control, was that if Eleni was kind to Lucas in period one, Lucas was kind to Erica in period two, Erica was kind to Jay in period three, and Jay was kind to Brecken in period four. This altruism, this kindness spread in this experiment to 3 degrees of separation, just like the observational work that we did earlier. And what's fascinating to me about this work is that we can see the signature of Eleni's kindness to Lucas in Jay's interactions with Brecken, even though neither Jay nor Brecken ever interacted with Eleni or Lucas. How Jay treats Brecken depends on how Eleni treated Lucas, even though these two never see those two. And this geodesic spread across the network ties is different than the temporal spread across time, whereby when if Eleni is kind to Lucas, Lucas learns to be kind and is kind to Erica in period two, and Lysander in period three, and Bemi in period four, and so forth. In fact, if you add all the downstream benefits for every extra dollar that Eleni gives to Lucas, the network functions as a kind of matching grant, doubling the downstream kindness. So for every marginal dollar that Eleni gives to Lucas, all the downstream benefits wind up doubling. So one of the ideas that we've been converging on is that networks magnify whatever they are seeded with. That in fact, one of the deep and fundamental functions of human networks, one of the reasons we evolved to have them, is that they serve as a kind of social magnification phenomenon. Now, they will magnify good and bad things. They will magnify fascism and Ebola and violence, but equally they will magnify happiness and ideas and altruism. Indeed, a deep reason we might be programmed to live in networks, and not just merely in groups, is that the networks might permit and foster cooperation and enhance the returns on cooperation, and that the structure of the network might be highly relevant to this successful behavior. Now, this work with emotions and with cooperation, which are so fundamental, coupled with the idea that networks have a function, got us to thinking about the evolutionary basis of social networks themselves. Whenever human social networks have been mapped, they always look strikingly similarly. And you can actually mathematically analyze these networks in a variety of ways we can discuss if you're interested. And whenever the mathematics of these networks, the topology has been studied, it always looks very similar, whether it's 56 high school students and their friends shown in the upper left, or 105 college students and their friends shown in the upper right, or this is a sample taken from a telephone network of 8 million people in a European country. Every individual and who they call, and you can look at the frequency of their calls and the existence of their calls. This is a small portion of the network of 400 people. This network looks the same. Or if you look at scientific collaborators, these are scientists and who they're collaborating with. All of these networks look very similar both visually and mathematically. But they never look like this. They never look like a regular lattice. There has been no naturally occurring social network that's ever been mapped that even remotely resembles this kind of structure. Why not? The striking patterns of human social networks, their ubiquity, and their apparent purpose beg the question of whether we evolved to have them and to have particular kinds of social networks in the first place. And so now the questions become, why do networks have the structure that they do? And to understand this, we need to dissect network structure a little bit first. So first of all, notice that in this type of a network, every position is isomorphic to every other position. Every individual has 8 friends. Every one of their friends has 8 friends. And if you took this surface and wrapped it around the surface of a sphere, or more properly in 3 dimensions, around the surface of a torus or a donut, every position would be equally distant from the edge and equally central from every other one. But real networks look completely different. So for example, compare nodes B, they look like this, and different individuals can occupy different structural locations within the network. Compare node B that has 4 friends to node D that has 6 friends. This is known as the degree of a node. And if you talk to human beings, they're aware of this property of themselves. I've got 4 friends. I've got 6 friends. I've got no friends. I've got 10 friends. People know this about themselves. But there are other properties of individuals that they do not appreciate about themselves. Compare nodes C and D. C and D both have 6 friends, but we can see with this bird's eye view that they occupy structurally very different locations within the network. And I can cultivate this intuition in you by asking you, who would you rather be if a deadly germ was spreading through the network, C or D?
D.
Yeah? It's obvious, right? D is on the edge of the network. The mean path length between D and every other node is longer than the mean path length between C and every other node. So D has a lower centrality than C. Now who would you rather be if a juicy piece of gossip were spreading through the network? C, right? So people often ask me, where is the best location to be in a network? And I tell them the very unsatisfying answer that it depends. In part, it depends on what's spreading through the network. If a germ is spreading through the network, it's better to be on the edge. If information is spreading through the network, it's better to be in the middle. Now contrast nodes A and B. They both have 4 connections. But there's a difference between A and B, and the difference is that A has higher transitivity. The friend of a friend of A's is back again a friend of A's, whereas the friend of a friend of B's is not a friend of B's. Now imagine you were a prehistoric human, and your task was to kill a mastodon. Get together with your friends and go kill the thing. Who would you rather be, A or B? A, get together with your friends. They all know each other. Work together and go kill the damn thing. Now, on the other hand, who would you rather be if the task was not to kill a mastodon, but to find a mastodon? You would rather be B, because in the case of A, there's a lot of redundancy in the information in the system. Do you know where the mastodon is? No, do you know where the mastodon is? Your friend's friend is your friend. It comes right back to you. Whereas in B, your friend's friend is able to reach further into the system and bring back information about the location of predators or prey. So we published a paper a few years ago, also in PNAS, in which we looked at the heritability of these 3 traits. On the y-axis is the percent of the variance that's explained, or the heritability, and then these 3 basic network traits are shown in the columns. What we found is that 46% of the variation in how many friends people have can be explained by their genes. Now, this is not too surprising, because most of us have the basic understanding that people vary in how shy or gregarious they are. Some people are shy and don't want many friends. Some people are gregarious and want many friends. That there would be a partially genetic basis to this inclination is not a shocker. But in addition, we also found that 47% of the variation in transitivity could also be explained by their genes. This is a very bizarre result. What I've just told you is that if you have Tom, Dick, and Harry in a room, whether Dick is friends with Harry depends not just on Dick's genes or on Harry's genes, but on Tom's genes. Whether this person is a friend with that person depends on the genetic constitution of some third party. How can that be? We think the reason is that people vary in their inclination to introduce their friends to each other. Some of us knit the networks around us together, and others of us keep our friends separate and don't introduce them to each other. Finally, in very interesting ways, even 29% of the variation in how central you are in the network might be explained by your genes. So where you are in this vast fabric of humanity depends in part on your genes. The fundamental reality of our desire for particular kinds of connection, it turns out, has always been with us. And in turn, this variation in topological preferences, in our preferences, the fact that people vary in their sort of preferences and where they might want to be in a network, and the exercise of choice in friendship selection can result in, or actually reflect, a kind of very interesting genetic structuring of human populations. Humans are unusual, very unusual as a species, in that we form long-term, non-reproductive unions with other members of our species. Most of our contacts are not our kin. This is very interesting. There are very few species on the planet that actually have friends. Most species, sexually reproducing species, of course, mate, but we're very distinctive in that we do this. We have preferences for the kinds of friends we want, where we want to be in the network, and preferences for the kinds of friends we have. And this, in turn, means that we can, each of us, come to live in the sea of genes of others, others we choose to connect to. So this paper is another paper we just published in PNAS a year ago, in which we looked at genotypic information on individuals, which particular genes is largely irrelevant to the claims being made in the study. This happened to be the DRD2, the dopamine receptor D2 variant. And it turns out that there's a correlation above that expected due to chance in the variants of the gene seen in groups of interconnected friends, a finding which is also firmed up in more formal statistical models, and a finding that has since been replicated by others. The basic argument here is that there appears to be homophily on these genotypes within this social fabric. So it's not just that individuals to whom you're connected share phenotypes, nor even that they share similar genotypes, but rather at down to the single nucleotide polymorphism level and the variants at that SNP level, you and your friends are more likely to share those variants. And this structure can arise for a variety of possible reasons. Most obviously, it could due to population stratification. So if Greeks have one particular, are more prone to have one set of genetic variants, and I am more likely as a person of Greek descent to befriend other Greeks, we shouldn't be surprised if me and my friends are similar at the single nucleotide polymorphism level. But our analyses took into account that population stratification. And after taking into account PopStrat, there are a number of possible further explanations. One idea is that we might actually affirmatively choose our friends by some diverse set of processes such that they resemble us on a genetic level. Another possibility is that we don't exercise choice in friendship, but rather choice of environment. So maybe, for example, I like to run, and I like to go to an environment where I can run. And there I find other people who like to run. And both me and they have genes that predispose us to being able to run, and we shouldn't be surprised that I resemble those individuals. And last, it could be that it's not anything I do, but rather selection by others. So maybe Magdalen College admits very intelligent people, there's some genetic basis for intelligence, and we find that people at Magdalen befriend other peoples at Magdalen, and we shouldn't be surprised that they would have similar genetic variants at particular loci. So what happens to us may thus depend not only on our own genes, but also the genes of our friends. Our phenotype might be a product not only of our own genotype, but also the genotype of our friends, who we in turn choose. And this is easier to understand if you consider some work done by other individuals in Europe doing some experiments with hens. And if you're a hen, a very important phenotype is your feather condition. And what they did is they caged hens, and they experimentally manipulated which hens were near the index hens. And they found that the feather condition of the index hen depended more on the genes of the nearby hens than of the index hen. And it's not hard to begin to imagine a mechanism by which that might happen. Maybe you're caged near other violent hens, and those hens like peck at you. And something about that pecking behavior of those other hens explains your phenotype, your feather condition. So this means that there may be genetic origins and genetic implications of friendship. And this in turn means that natural selection might operate at the level of friendship groups and not just reproductive unions, which might have evolutionary significance. An organism's fitness may depend in part on the friends it chooses. And in fact, we may be metagenomic with respect to our friends. So there's a lot of interest right now in understanding the genes of the germs within us, the bacteria within our gut or on our skin, and claims being made about how our fitness depends not only on our own genes, but the genes of these bacteria within us. But I would argue that same idea can be extended to include the friends around us, that our fitness might depend, that we might be metagenomic, not only with respect to the pathogens in and on us, but also with respect to the people around us. And it's important to sort all this out, since genes might be associated both with network topology and with behavioral outcomes. So for example, at the beginning, I alluded to some early work that we had done. Very quickly, I blew through that. that suggested that social networks may have something to do with behaviors like obesity or happiness, also with addiction or altruism. And I showed you very quickly some work on obesity, happiness, and altruism. Other scientists have been looking at the genetic basis of these behaviors, for example, looking at the dopamine and serotonin pathways to discern the role that they might play in these behaviors. But now I've just told you that genes might have something to do with social networks. So maybe, in fact, one of the ways that genes affect these behaviors is not directly by what they do to our biochemistry or our anatomy, not by what they do in our bodies, but rather what they do outside of our bodies, a kind of backdoor path, such that we've been previously overestimating the role of genes internally by neglecting the outside of our body pathway that leads through this back door. And this, in turn, raises still further questions about why networks might be genetically encoded. And we think part of this must be because networks enhance our fitness. So, to present you some more very recent work, if social network structure has biological and genetic antecedents and evolutionary significance, it begs the question of how ancient this structure is and whether we can document such structural features in human populations living in non-modernized settings. And in order to study this, we decided to study the Hadza hunter-gatherers. Now, the Hadza are one of the few last remaining populations of hunter-gatherers on the planet. There are only about 1,000 of them left. Only about 600 still live in the traditional way. There are just a few hundred adult Hadza who still live in the traditional way. And they live around Lake Ayasi in Tanzania. They have no fixed abodes. They do not build any dwellings in which to live. They sleep under the stars. They're pre-agricultural and naturally reproducing population. They hunt and they gather for their food, and they roam around these 4,000 square kilometers. And 2 summers ago, one of my postdocs, Corin Apicella, spent the summer in partnering with Frank Marlowe, one of the world's leading authorities on the Hadza, one of the world's leading ethnographers. We decided we were going to map the social networks. And so she drove around these 4,000 square kilometers. And we had made, prior to her going into the field, a kind of photographic census of the Hadza, a kind of Hadza Facebook. So we systematically had pictures of all adult Hadza, and we created these big posters. And whenever we found an adult Hadza, we asked that individual to tell us who their friends were. And we asked them to do this in a number of ways. One way we discern ties. Now, so in westernized populations, when you do this, the standard question is to ask people, who do you spend free time with? And who do you discuss important matters with? Those questions don't make a lot of sense in the setting of Hadza. So we had to come up with a couple of alternative questions. One was what we called the camping network. With whom would you like to live after this camp? And these individuals, we restricted them to same-sex respondents because we didn't want people to identify desired sexual partners for their next campmates. They could choose people that were in or out of their current camp. Hadza camps have only about 30 people. They're very small, these sort of local camps that form on the savannah, and then they move from place to place. And they could choose up to 10 individuals. And in addition, we did something else. The Hadza love honey. It's difficult for Hadza to get honey. They get stung by bees. It's not commonly found and so forth. We took honey sticks into the field, and we gave each Hadza respondent 3 honey sticks. And we asked them, of all the adults that currently live with you, who would you like to give a gift of honey to? They could not keep it to themselves. They had to give it away. And we're going to call this the gift network. And again, this gift was anonymous, just like the previous was anonymous. And when we mapped the campmate network for Hadza females, this is what it looked like. And in fact, visually, you might be able to form the impression that it looks very similar, if not identical, to the kinds of networks I showed you earlier of modernized human populations. And in fact, we find many features common in social networks in modernized populations also present in the Hadza. They have the same, and this paper was just published in Nature a few months ago, they had the same degree distribution. That is to say, the same variance in how many friends, like how many people had 1 friend, 2 friends, 3 friends, 4 friends. The distribution in the Hadza was the same as in modernized populations. They evinced the same tendency to homophily. They had the same geographic decay. People were less likely to nominate as friends people who lived further away. They had the same transitivity that we do, the triadic closure. They had a very interesting property called degree assortativity, which is popular people prefer to befriend popular people and unpopular people, unpopular people. The Hadza do that just like we do. And they had the same reciprocity, which is that if I nominate David as my friend, and unbeknownst, he then is asked, and he does not know that I've nominated him, he's more likely to reciprocate that nomination. So there are a variety of ways in which Hadza networks look just like ours. And in fact, in a very real sense, I think the spread of germs is the price we pay for for the spread of ideas. I think we assemble ourselves into networks that have particular architectures which are optimized for the dissemination of certain types of phenomena, like information, but in so doing, in assembling ourselves into these networks, we place ourselves at risk for the flow of other non-desirable properties like germs or violence. Now, while we were there with the Hadza, we also had them play a public goods game to evaluate their cooperativeness, very similar to the game I discussed earlier. And here is a map of the Hadza network. We make the dot size now proportional to how generous people are. Bigger dots are more generous people, and we color the dots as well. So the big yellow dots are the most generous, the medium orange dots are in between, and the red dots are the defectors, the people that aren't generous. And you can see clustering of generous and ungenerous individuals within this system. But mathematically analyze it, just like we did before, you find that these clusters spread to 2 degrees of separation in both kinds of networks, both the campmate network and the gift network. You can see that, for instance, this is the increase in ego donation for each unit donated by the altar. And you can see this is at 1 degree of separation, 2 degrees of separation, and 3 degrees of separation. But this does not happen because generous people attract more friends or make more friendship nominations. So, for example, the increase in the odds of a social tie on the y-axis, and this is how much the ego gives, doesn't affect his likelihood of attracting ties, of sending outward ties. Or how much the altar gives, how much my friend gives, doesn't attract the probability that I'll befriend him. Rather, what we find is that there's a probability of homophily ungenerosity. So what explains the clustering within the system is the fact that cooperative individuals preferentially attach to cooperative individuals, not that cooperative individuals preferentially acquire more ties. And in fact, when we looked at the 17 Hadza camps, we found much more between camp variance than within camp variance in generosity. So what we found, for example, is that Hadza camps, the people that live in Hadza camps, are more likely to resemble each other in terms of how generous they are than they are to resemble individuals that live in other camps. So what's happening is Hadza sort themselves into camps with other generous people. If you're a generous Hadza, you preferentially camp with other generous Hadza. You exclude the ungenerous ones, the defectors, and the defectors are stuck camping with other defectors. And this is because food is shared communally amongst the Hadza. If you bring food into the camp, everyone shares it. So the Hadza actively rewire their networks to foster and sustain this kind of cooperation. Now, human populations are both highly cooperative and highly organized. And interactions are not random, but rather are structured in social networks. And importantly, these networks are often dynamic, changing in response to the behavior of one's social partners. And this, in turn, permits an important form of conditional action that has been explored theoretically, but has received very little empirical attention. The point here is that people can respond to the cooperation or defection of other people not just by changing their behavior. So if you're kind to me, am I then kind to you? Or if you defect, do I defect? That's a kind of behavioral reciprocity. But we humans also do something else, which is we rewire our networks. If you defect from me, if you're unkind to me, I cut the ties to you. And if you're kind, I preferentially form a tie to you. So we're constantly reshaping and rewiring the networks around us. So moving very far from the field of the Hadza, we recently published an experiment in which we recruited Amazon Mechanical Turk workers. We created a virtual laboratory online, and we recruited people from around the world to come to this virtual lab and interact with each other in kind of experimental settings that we controlled. So in one situation, people were dropped into a world, into a network, in which the ties were fixed. So I come, and I'm assigned, these are the people that you're going to interact with. Now play a public goods game with those individuals. And in a fixed network, and then they play repeatedly across time, again and again and again with the people to whom I'm connected. And at the beginning of the experiment, the cooperative individuals are shown in blue and the defectors are shown in red. About 60% of the people are cooperative. We, as a species, tend to be cooperative. And what happens is across time in this network in which I can't control who I interact with is gradually everyone becomes a defector. I'm stuck with these individuals. They take advantage of me. They defect. And so I switch my behavior from cooperation to defection, and cooperation disappears from the system. We cannot sustain cooperation in a world in which people are obliged to interact with specific other individuals and cannot control their network structure. Conversely, in an experiment in which we permitted people to rewire their network ties, to cut ties to defectors and to form ties preferentially to cooperators, cooperation persists in the system. So how we manipulate the rules of the game, as it were, how we allow people to wire or rewire the networks, is crucial in understanding the emergence and the sustenance of cooperation. We actually had four different experimental treatments in that experiment. At the beginning, in all four arms, about 60% were cooperative. In the green line here shows what happens to cooperation across time, across the rounds. It disappears, as I showed you in the cartoons a moment ago. We also had some other treatments. For instance, random reassignment with each round, which is shown in red, cooperation disappears. Slow rewiring rate, which is shown in yellow, cooperation disappears. We call that the viscous dynamic condition. And a rapid rewiring rate, which is shown in blue, in which cooperation persists across time. And we've since gone on in unpublished work to explore the so-called parameter space of this to see under which optimal conditions can we sustain humans' natural tendency to cooperate by permitting a kind of network rewiring. So let me close then with one argument about a connected life. Because the question is, what's the point of a connected life? How does it help us as individuals and as a species? And it turns out that networks are a resource that we can all use. They're a kind of social capital. Now, most people, when they think about capital, think about money. But really, capital is any stock of resources that can be put to productive use. And two further key ideas about capital are that in order to create capital, you have to invest skill and effort. You have to know something and do something to create capital. And second, and more subtle and much more interesting, is that in order to make capital or create capital, you have to make changes in a substance that make it yield a higher rate of return than it otherwise would. You have to transmute the natural world. You have to change matter in order to create capital and make it a stock of wealth and a source of productive power. So let me give you an example of this. For a farm is a stock of capital. It's a reservoir of wealth. You invest skill and effort, and you clear the land, and you make a farm. And the farm is more valuable than the land because you can do things with the farm that you couldn't do with the forest, namely grow fruits and vegetables and grains and flowers. Okay? So the farm is a reservoir of wealth and a stock of productive power because you've invested skill and effort, and you've transmuted the material world to make it into a farm. Or another example is this. Consider this tree. You can invest skill and effort and convert the tree into lumber. And the lumber is more valuable than the tree because you can do things with the lumber you couldn't do with the tree, such as make a violin. You can invest still more skill and effort, and you can make a violin. And you can do things with a violin that you couldn't do with the lumber, namely make music. So at every step of the way, you work upon the material world, and that's what makes it a source of capital, a stock of wealth, and a reservoir of productive power. Now, in the 1960s, a key change in thinking occurred among social scientists. So they began to think about human capital. And the chief example of human capital is education. So you can take this dissolute former graduate student of mine who's a drunkard, and you can invest skill and effort, and you can clean him up so that he's no longer a drunkard, and now he's more productive, and he's more capable of doing things that he couldn't do before. Or you can invest still more skill and effort and give him an education. You can change his mind. You can work upon the neurons of his brain, and that's what makes him a stock of capital and a reservoir of productive power. Now, just like physical capital is created by a change in the material world, and human capital is a change in persons, social capital is a change in the relations among persons, a change that renders the group more productive and capable of doing things it was not previously able to do. And in fact, I think that's one of the reasons we evolved to have social networks. They are a form of social capital. They are a reservoir of wealth and productive power that we can all draw on. And I'll just close with this analogy, which actually is fitting considering the president of Maudlin. Consider these two simple objects, which, as we all learned in high school chemistry, are both made of carbon. They're allotropes of carbon. And if you connect the carbon atoms one way, you get graphite, which is soft and dark. And if you connect them another way, you get diamond, which is hard and clear. And there are two key ideas here. First of all, these properties of softness and darkness and hardness and clearness do not reside in the carbon atoms. They are not properties per se of the carbon atoms, but rather of the collection of carbon atoms, first. And second, which properties you get are different depending on how you connect the carbon atoms to each other. Similarly, the pattern of our connections affects the properties of our social groups. It is the ties between people that make the whole greater than the sum of its parts. New properties, maybe even cooperation, may emerge because of the connections, because of the ties between people, and not necessarily the people themselves. Our experience of the world also depends on the actual structure of the social ties around us, near and far. Thank you. Do you want me to do questions? Sure.
Okay, so thank you so much for that incredibly compelling account of human social networks and its implications for evolution. We now have time for some questions. So if I could ask you to try and shout the question, and if you could
repeat it, sure. You don't have to shout it. I think I can hear it, but I will repeat it. Yeah.
Professor, thank you for a very stimulating talk. I have a question for you, which is about a practical problem I have. So, Woody Kong, editor of the Journal of Public Mental Health. And when I was part of the British government's mental health strategy, a rift conceptually developed among the members. And this became really fierce when the Office for National Statistics tried to develop a national measure of well-being.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the measure that they went with, against my advice, and interestingly, the advice of everyone born east of Suez, there was a very strong anthropological difference in the views on well-being. But they went with measures that were all I this. Every question was egocentric, individualistic, supposedly about well-being. Those of us who came from different cultures saw well-being as a collective experience, and we wanted lots of we questions. And we felt that was the basis for something that was in the original mental health strategy, resilience. Resilient people have connections of the sort you're talking about. And if they don't have those connections, they die out. How can we persuade, particularly the current government, dominated by conservatives, I think the cabinet office, they don't like the we questions. They just don't like them. How can we shift them conceptually?
Well, I would say, first of all, it's always very tempting in any kind of intellectual conversation to set up what I would regard as false dichotomies. Not that you've set that up, but I'm just saying people, you know, so people say either it's genetic or it's cultural. That's totally stupid. I mean, most social processes are both, okay? There's a biological determinants of addiction and there's social determinants of addiction, and it's naive to set it up. And similarly, I think it would be wrong to imagine that either we're going to have individualistic conceptions of human experience and emotion, or we're going to have collective ones. In an ideal world, yes, of course, exactly. In an ideal world, we would find synthetic approaches that captured both elements. And I think there's absolutely a sense, in work I didn't show you today, we showed that negative affect, like depression and unhappiness, can also spread. And in fact, some fraction of the variance in your suicidality, your unhappiness, your depression, depend, not all of it, but some significant fraction of it depends on the like experiences of other individuals to whom you're connected. And so I think a proper account of these types of phenomena at the collective level would take into account their collective nature, absolutely. Yeah.
I'm interested in the comment you made about the spread of germs through the network.
Yes.
High-speed pace for the spread of information.
Yeah.
And I wonder if you might comment on how that might have changed now that a lot of our connections are via methods where you can't spread germs, like telephone or Facebook or whatever, where you can spread information, but you're not going to catch a deadly germ from somebody over Facebook.
Yeah, I think, but you still are connected. And one of the things that's so interesting to me is, I give a couple of little sort of anecdotes to support the claim that the invention of modern telecommunications really has not fundamentally modified our fundamental social reality. And one little anecdote I give is, imagine you could talk to my great-grandmother, and you asked her when she was a 10-year-old girl, which would have been around 1900, how many friends did she have? And she would say, I have one best friend or two best friends, and there are four or five of us girls in a little group. And if you talk to my daughter, who has an iPhone in her pocket, and asked her the same question, she'd give you exactly the same answer. So there's something very deep and fundamental about this. In fact, Robin Dunbar was talking yesterday about like the closest in group. It's about five, which is very interesting, actually, and doesn't change across cultures, which is also very interesting, or is very relatively invariant. Or similarly, if I asked you what's the size of a military company in the Roman army, most of you would know it's about 100, 120 men. There's a centurion and 10 decurions. And in the modern British army, it's about the same. And this, despite the fact that we've invented the printing press, telegraphy, telephony, radar, the internet, and so forth. Because what constrains our interactions is not the technology, but rather the human mind. So these media that we've invented are very important, definitely change our society, but there's something very deep that they aren't changing. And in fact, you, even if you use the phone to talk to 100 people, you're still interacting face-to-face with some people. You'd not become a hermit and not interact with anybody. So now the degree of sortativity thing, I won't go into that now, there's not enough time, but there's some very interesting ways in which it turns out that if you sat down on first principles mathematically and said, okay, I've got 500 people and 2,500 ties, so each on average, every node has 5 connections, what's the mathematical structure I would design from first principles to minimize the ability of germs to spread in this system? So you do all the math, you work it out. It turns out that you would confer upon the group something known as degree of sortativity. And lo and behold, we humans do that. We just like cooperation, epidemic resistance is an emergent property of human social groups, just like the carbon example I gave. So you take the same people and you assemble them one way, they're less cooperative and, let's say, more prone to infection. You assemble the same people, same individuals, same immunity that they have, assemble them another way, they're more cooperative and less prone to infection. It, in my judgment, cannot be a coincidence that we do that. Yeah.
Following on from that last point, I advise communication companies on social networks, and they're getting it.
They do or aren't getting it?
They don't.
They don't get it, yeah.
Particularly in terms of the fluidity.
Yes.
I wonder if you thought there was a need to realign public perception, in particular media perception, along the lines you've been talking about, because there's a growing dysfunction between the goals
Yeah, it's interesting. We discussed that in our book Connected in the last chapter. We've looked a lot at how modern telecommunications networks do and do not resemble the more fundamental networks that we've been discussing today. And we have a kind of, after lots of thought about this for a few years, we concluded that they're the same but different, is our conclusion. And they're the same in that the sort of basic topology of the network is the same regardless of whether you have modern telecommunications or so-called primitive networks. And our desire for influence is similar in today as it was hundreds of years ago. But there are absolutely ways, which I think you're alluding to, that modern networks can be different. The scale, for example, is very different. The specificity, even 15 or 20 years ago, if you wanted to find a, Norwegian ornithologist, this was not easy to do 20 years ago. Now it's really simple to find a Norwegian ornithologist. And so there's something about the ability to identify specific individuals with whom to connect that has changed in the modern world. So I think getting the balance right, seeing which parts of the experience haven't changed and needn't change or we don't want to change, and which parts have changed or are mutable, I think is a key question. Oh, yeah. Yes. That's exactly right. In fact, we had an article that was published when that paper that I just showed, that very abstract paper on the rewiring thing, was published in the PNAS. I was talking to a friend of mine, and he said, this actually has significant implications for public policy with respect to, in the United States, we have a lot of incentives for people to be able to buy their own homes and community stabilization, like keep communities stable, make it difficult for people to move. And my friend said, well, actually, what you really want is you might not want that so much. You might want to make it easy for people to leave a situation in which they are being abused or being preyed on by criminals or whatever. That stabilizing communities is not optimal necessarily. And so, in fact, it turns out there's a sweet spot which we've been investigating. Yeah. Yes. So it's not that the unfriendly, the defectors, the bad guys, clearly would prefer not to be with other bad guys. They would prefer to be able to exploit, the more generous individuals, but they are shunned by the more generous individuals. So the generous individuals preferentially, first of all, I should say we only have statics. We don't have dynamics in the Hadza. So unlike the experiments in which we had dynamics, the Hadza, unfortunately, we could only do one point in time. So what I'm telling you is speculation. I'm not 100% sure. Because I can't follow it across time, the same individuals. But what we've gathered is that what happens is that the cooperative individuals preferentially form attachments to other cooperative individuals and exclude them. And the defectors then have no choice but to camp with each other. So you had a group of selfish individuals. Am I answering your question or no?
But why do they continue? Why don't the friendly groups begin to...
You mean across the scope of evolutionary time or like historical time?
Oh,
well, they try to make inroads. So what'll happen is if you talk to ethnographers of the Hadza, you have a nice cooperative group here that's very generous, and some little guy will come in wants to exploit them, and they don't abuse this person or kill them or do anything like that, but they move on. They leave him behind. They don't want to be with this individual. So they can't. The Hadza rewire their networks. That was the point of the experiment, to show that in the experimental setting, the way it could happen is through this rewiring process. So let's say you're a defector, and here I am with these cooperative individuals. You come and join us. You share our food, but you don't contribute to the collectivity. After a while, every 6 weeks, the Hadza camps change location. We get up in the middle of the night and go somewhere else and leave you behind. So you can't camp with us anymore. That's the claim. I can't tell you for sure because we don't have dynamics in that data set. Okay, before you go then, last I'm going to show you some slides by a colleague of mine, Mark Fricker, who's here at Pembroke in Oxford, which is my favorite example of emergence, not from chemistry, but from biology. So this is one of the simplest organisms on the planet. It's an amoeboid fungus. It's called a slime mold. You have a wonderful department of mycology here at Oxford University, and Mark is a fantastic academic, a fantastic scholar. And one of the basic things that this organism does, basically the only thing it does, is it digests cellulose. So it lives on the forest floor. Each little cell of this amoeboid fungus fuses with a nearby cell, and they form these long tubes where they forage the forest floor for debris, for cellulose. And then when they digest the food, they distribute the waste to the periphery. So they make these networks. And I don't know what it's like in England, but in New England, if you lift up wet leaves in the fall, you see those little white filaments? Do you have them here? Those little white filaments are fungal networks, the fungi forming these little networks and making these things on the forest floor. Now, if I asked you if this amoeboid fungus was intelligent, for example, could it solve mazes, you would probably say to me, what the hell are you talking about? But here's some nice work done by my colleague Toshi Nakagaki, who decided, and published in Nature about 10 years ago, who decided to plate this amoeboid fungus onto a maze, and at the entrance and at the exit of the maze, he put a little oat flake, which is a very simple form of cellulose, and then he let the fungus do what it does. It sort of bubbles up and it fuses with each other till the entire maze is plated. Here's the entrance and the exit to the maze and the oat flakes. The whole maze gets plated, and all the paths drive back in the maze except the one most efficient path through the maze. In fact, this amoeboid fungus is better able to solve mazes than Toshi's graduate students. But not than my graduate students. My graduate students are better than this. And this has lent to all kinds of bioengineering ideas. And so Mark Fricker, what he did was he took the map of England and he put an oat flake at every city and he let the fungus solve the problem of what the most efficient network of railway or communication would be. And here on the right is the railway network constructed by the fungus. And on the left is the railway network made by British railway engineers over 200 years. And actually, when this map was shown to British railway engineers, they said, oh my God, what a brilliant idea. You could put a trunk line between here and there, and that would be great load balancing, and if there was a disaster at this railway station, you could route traffic around it, and so forth. Which resulted in Mark being appointed, apparently by the Queen, to Her Majesty's Commission on the Rails. So here's this British mycologist that's now hanging out with railway engineers. This is a great example, in my eye, of emergence. Thank you very much.